Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What creates the gap between science and philosophy, and what role does each play in the greatest achievements of the other? While science does a great job of revealing how the world works, it can't tell us how we should behave or what we should value. On the other hand, my guest today would remind philosophers that only with the best scientific information can they pursue the sort of deeper knowledge and meaning they seek. Massimo Pigliucci is professor in the philosophy program at the City University of New York's Graduate Center and former professor of biology at Stony Brook University. He writes about all this in his new book, Answers for Aristotle, How Science and Philosophy Can Lead Us to a More Meaningful Life. Massimo, welcome back to Think.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be back.
This book is essentially a celebration of what you call sci-fi, and the phi in this case is spelled P-H-I for philosophy.
Right.
What makes it such a powerful combination for understanding not just the world, but the human condition?
Well, the basic idea is that if you look at the last couple of millennia or more of intellectual traditions throughout the world, but particularly, of course, in the Western cultural traditions, there are two things that emerge very clearly, it seems to me, as deep and important and the purveyor of a lot of the truths that we know about the world. One is science, which tells us as best as we can know it about how the world actually is, you know, the empirical stuff. What makes the basic building blocks of the world, how does the human body work and so on and so forth, or the human brain in particular work. And the other one, of course, is philosophy, which has a 2.5 millennia-long tradition of reflecting on the same issues. And philosophy doesn't do empirical work, of course, especially these days as a professional, as a scholarly field. But it has the tools to reflect critically on not only what science tells us, but also on sort of the general ways in which we want to think about our place in the universe, what we're doing, why we're doing what it is that we do during our lives. So the idea was that combining the two traditions, philosophy and science, which often, unfortunately, don't talk to each other, even though one derived from the other. I mean, science was, in fact, natural philosophy until, you know, a couple of centuries ago. But these days they don't talk much to each other. In fact, there's quite a bit of distrust. A lot of philosophers are wary of sort of what they see as a scientistic approach to things, as science taking over or attempting to take over areas where it doesn't belong, and vice versa. Scientists are feeling a little bit smug about the successes of the natural sciences over the last couple of hundred years, essentially often dismissing philosophy as sort of a leftover of ancient times. I think that those are both mistakes of a different type, and so I'm trying to bring them back together, basically.
Do you think the source of the conflict, Massimo, is the different strategies used by scientists and philosophers to attempt to reveal truth by examining available information?
To some extent, that is true, although I wouldn't want to stress too much the differences, in fact, between science and philosophy, because even though as they are practiced today, as academic fields, they are quite different. I mean, if you read a typical book or paper in philosophy, it will feel and look very different from a typical book or paper in science. But still, they're both interested in deploying, you know, reason and evidence to figure out how the world works. What happened, I think, during the last few centuries is sort of a division of labor, where science has become independent of philosophy proper, and it has focused on very specific questions that can be answered empirically by observation or experimentation. And philosophy, therefore, has been, in some sense, freed to think more broadly about issues of ethics or metaphysics or things for which science really has very little to actually tell us in terms of sort of an empirical grounds.
You write, to go to a concrete example here, you write about the seemingly perplexing problem of overweight and obesity, which persists even when people who struggle with their weight are educated about healthy habits and wish to lose weight. Talk about how the sci-fi combination can help us understand this issue more fully.
Right. As I explained in the beginning of the book, that actually is a problem that has affected me personally. I'm now a pretty healthy person, but when I was younger, that wasn't the case. And so I actually had first-hand experience of the situation. And one of the things that did change for me was, first of all, beginning to pay attention to the science, and in particular, you know, basic information about the human body and metabolism, the different ways in which the body metabolizes different different chemicals, that knowledge empowered me to make some choices that were much better informed than they might have been before. I actually became aware of these things. So that's the empirical evidence. But the philosophy sort of came into it a little later when I started reflecting more broadly because of my interest in philosophy about, you know, okay, but what sort of person do I want to be and what is important for me and why? And it turns out that the weight issue was not important necessarily for the obvious reasons in terms of, you know, self-esteem and, you know, the way you look to others and all that. But it was sort of a part of a more general quest for a flourishing life, and being fit both mentally and physically helped me, concentrating on doing things in life that I care for. So I basically deployed, without knowing it at the time, because we're talking about a couple of decades ago, I deployed what I call now the sci-fi or sci-fi approach. You know, so I try to learn as much as possible about the facts on the ground, but I also trying to start sort of reflecting more broadly about what was the meaning of those facts as far as my personal life was concerned.
So in the world of modern science, philosophy cannot simply ignore the findings of science and expect to reach a fundamentally true conclusion. Was this a conflict that didn't exist in quite that same form in the day of, say, Aristotle, who is mentioned in the title of your book?
Yes, absolutely. So these days, I don't think one can do any serious philosophy without taking on board the science, especially in certain areas of philosophy. I mean, you cannot do, for instance, metaphysics, I think, today. That is, you can't think about the fundamental structure of the world unless you know a heck of a lot about physics. But that wasn't always the case. In fact, it's a fairly recent development. In philosophy, there has been a long history going back all the way to Plato of trying to figure out universal truths about the world by thinking about it, by using reason. Now, today this sounds very quaint and sort of and naive, but at the time we had to remember that Plato was highly influenced by the success of the Pythagorean school. Pythagoras showed that you could, in fact, just sit there and think about stuff and come up with all sorts of marvelous insights into numbers and geometrical figures and things like that. So Plato thought, well, why not adopt the same approach to everything, not just mathematics and geometry? Well, turns out we can't. We need empirical evidence to figure out how the world actually is, as opposed to sort of the logic and mathematics of it. We need the empirical evidence. And actually, one of the people that figured that out was Descartes. Descartes was the last philosopher back in the 16th century who really tried seriously to approach the understanding of the world from a Platonic perspective, so from this perspective, or let me think and sit down and think what I can find out. And he failed. Mm-hmm. He realized that, no, you really can't get very far with that. And incidentally, Descartes thought of himself actually as a physicist more than as a philosopher. This was a transition period in the history of science where all of the prominent scientists that we think of today, including Galileo and Newton, actually thought of themselves as philosophers. And the reason we remember Newton today as a physicist as opposed to a philosopher, and remember Descartes as a philosopher as opposed to a physicist, is because Newton got the physics right, and his philosophy wasn't very good. On the other hand, Descartes got the physics wrong, and his philosophy was much better.
What do you think makes you different, that you are equally comfortable with a foot in both worlds?
I wouldn't say that I'm equally comfortable, but I am somewhat more comfortable probably than most of my colleagues because I've actually experienced both worlds deeply from an academic perspective. Right, so I started out, as you mentioned, my career as an evolutionary biologist. I got my PhD in biology at the University of Connecticut, and then I established a lab and I did empirical, you know, experimental work in plant biology for, you know, almost two decades. And then sort of this midlife crisis basically hit, and I wanted to do something different. So I went back and I nurtured my already existing interest in philosophy, but I took it seriously. I went back to actually graduate school and got a PhD in philosophy because I wanted to be taken seriously by my what eventually became my new colleagues. So now that I'm doing philosophy full-time, it is certainly the case that my writings don't have anything directly to do with science. I don't do empirical research anymore. But I have a fairly good firsthand knowledge of how science works because I was a scientist for 20 years. So that's unusual, and there are not many. There are scientists who are very interested in philosophy, and there are certainly a lot of philosophers that are interested in science, but it's pretty rare to find somebody who's actually had a professional career in both fields, and so that perhaps is what makes sort of my insights hopefully a little more helpful than most.
My guest is Massimo Piliucci. He is professor in the philosophy program at the City University of New York's Graduate Center and former professor of biology at Stony Brook University. His new book is called Answers for Aristotle, How Science and Philosophy Can Lead Us to a More Meaningful Life. You can be part of the conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We'll come back to our discussion with Professor Piliucci in a few minutes. Right now, we would encourage you to please take the couple of minutes that we are breaking away from the discussion to make your contribution of support to KERA online at kera.org or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. It's a pleasure today to have Professor Massimo Piliucci as our guest. We have a copy of his book, Answers for Aristotle, available for you when you join the station with a $120 contribution. That's $10 a month as a sustaining member. Of course, the book it's been out for a few months. It's widely read, widely reviewed, and it's available anywhere, but we would love to send you a copy of it with our thanks when you join the station because, you know, we're doing everything we can to try to say the right thing to get you to contribute to the station. And obviously, it's not necessarily working because we haven't heard from you yet at 888-694-6931. So I would encourage you to, tell us what the right thing is. Go to kera.org and put it in the little seven-word thing. It's at the top of the page. You can just click on it. You can add your seven words. You're not limited to seven words, but tell us what you would like to hear. What would convince you to support the station, or email us directly, think@kera.org. I'll see it here in a minute or so when you send it, and we'll share your thoughts on what we could do better during the membership campaign to convince you and your friends and people like you to support the station.
We know that we have listeners in this audience who get really excited every time we take on philosophy because it's not something that in contemporary broadcast media in particular that gets a whole lot of airplay. It's complicated. We're very fortunate for each interview on this show to last an hour, so we have a little bit of time to really get into complex subjects. Of course, this is just a taste of what you would get by reading Professor Piliucci's book, but maybe you are discovering this idea of exploring the apex, the interplay of science and philosophy because you're listening to this show. We think that and the many other things that you might discover listening to KERA are absolutely worth a gift of support for anyone who believes in leading a life of the mind, a life driven by ideas and thoughts and information rather than just stuff all the time and just sort of the empty calories of media information.
But if you want some stuff, we've got stuff
we
for
do
you
have
as
stuff.
Well. We have
book, we've got DVDs.
We have the book, we've got Downton Abbey DVDs,
we'll
got tote bags, we've got coffee mugs. I mean, go to kera.org. You can check out all the ways that you can choose to be thanked by us. And we'll thank you ourselves, too, on the air when you make your contribution. We'd love to read your name on the air. And also, you know, think about what would convince you? What would convince you to support KERA? What are we not saying? Go to kera.org and fill in your suggestion in the seven-word entry form at the top of the page, or email us, think@kera.org.
And do us the favor, if you have made your contribution of support or you're a current member, maybe you're a sustaining member, evangelize for us a little bit on social media. Let your friends on Twitter and on Facebook and on Google+, let them know that you are a member of KERA. You might just inspire somebody to make another contribution. Again, the number is 1-888-694-6931. Email our online address, kera.org. Back in 2 minutes with Massimo Piliucci.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Massimo Piliucci. He is professor in the philosophy program at the City University of New York's Graduate Center and former professor of biology at Stony Brook University. His newest book is called Answers for Aristotle, How Science and Philosophy Can Lead Us to a More Meaningful Life. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Massimo, I want to talk about right and wrong in this context. We've learned a great deal recently about the biological basis for our morality, but then there are the so-called trolley problems, which are an interesting example of contradictions that we have to deal with.
Right. So the trolley problems are a staple of sort of philosophical thought experiments. Philosophers tend to do thought experiments because they're much cheaper than actual experiments. and also you don't hurt anybody in reality. But the trolley problems are interesting for a variety of reasons. And in fact, they are now a good example of the combined science and philosophy approach because both scientists, in particular neurobiologists, and, of course, ethicists, moral philosophers, are using them. So the basic idea is this, that you can imagine a set of ideal circumstances, you know, imaginary circumstances, that would present somebody with a moral dilemma. And then the question is, well, given those circumstances, what would you do? And depending on how the subject answers, you're going to learn something about the often hidden sort of philosophical moral assumptions of that person. You can also study how that person is thinking by doing, for instance, an fMRI scan of his brain while he's engaging in the dilemma. So let me give you an example. The basic two versions of the dilemma work like this. Imagine that you're walking down the street and you see this trolley car coming down and it's clearly out of control. The conductor cannot stop it, and you'll see that if it keeps going on the track what it said, it will kill five people who are working to repair the tracks. Now, you do have an option. There is a lever next to you, and you can pull the lever, and the trolley will divert on a separate track where it will kill only one person. The first question, therefore, is, well, given those circumstances, there's nothing else you can do. You can't shout. You know, there's no other intervention you can do. The only choice is either to pull the lever or not to pull the lever. What would you do? Now, most people would, and this has been done cross-culturally, interestingly, most people would say, yes, I'll pull the lever. And the reasoning when they ask, well, why would you pull the lever, is, well, typically something on the lines of a consequentialist argument or a utilitarian argument, what a philosopher would call a utilitarian argument, which is, well, I'm saving five lives, we're losing one, and therefore there's a net gain of four people that are alive. Perfect, fine. Then the philosopher asks a second question based on a variation of the original dilemma, which gets a little more interesting. It says, well, imagine now that you got the same situation, the trolley's still going down the track and it's still hitting the five people. Now you don't have a lever. What's happening is that you're on top of a bridge above the trolley, and you, however, have the option of pushing a really big guy in front of you so that he's going to fall on the tracks and stop the trolley. Would you do it? Again, there's no other options, and yes, this is a thought experiment, so it would work perfectly well. The big guy will, in fact, stop the trolley. Mm-hmm. Well, now, the interesting thing is that most people actually answer no. I'm not going to push the guy. And when you ask them why, they're in trouble because the situation in terms of utilitarianism is exactly the same. You're still saving five people and killing one. But clearly most people understand that there is something different between pulling the lever and pushing somebody off the bridge. So it turns out that the neurobiology there comes to give you some interesting information about what's happening. Turns out that when you do when you present the dilemmas to people in an fMRI machine, in the first case, in the pulling the lever scenario, most of what's going on is that the frontal areas of your brain are involved in your decision making, and those are the areas that are known to be involved typically in sort of rational, logical decision making process. On the other hand, when you switch to the shall you push the guy off the bridge version of the dilemma, those areas of the frontal areas of the brain actually function much less actively, and what's lighting up is the amygdala. And the amygdala are these little areas of the brain that are involved in emotional responses. So what's happening basically is that one is switching from a dispassionate consideration of should I or should I not pull the lever to a very emotional consideration of, oh my God, should I? Can I push the guy actually, you know, physically off the bridge?
Hmm.
This is interesting for a variety of reasons. First of all, it shows that people tend to be inconsistent philosophically about their moral choices. But the other thing is that it does have practical applications. For instance, you know, imagine all of these discussions that we've been having recently about remote warfare,
yeah,
particularly the use of drones. One of the major criticisms of the use of the increased use of remote warfare is that it does exactly what it causes exactly the same situation in reverse between the two trolley dilemma, right? What it does is it removes the emotional component of being there in the middle of the action, and it sort of turns the whole thing into a video game.
Hmm.
It turns the whole thing into a very unemotional thing where you can get up in the morning, have breakfast with your family, go to work, kill a few people. It looks to you just like a video game anyway, and then you come back home and have dinner with your kids. And clearly that does have, you know, all sorts of interesting sort of moral implications in terms of, you know, do we want to do that? And there are also utilitarian considerations. You know, it is, in fact, safer, obviously, for our side to use that sort of approach. So that's an example, I think, of how the philosophy sets up the problem and it analyzes the people's responses. The biology, the neurobiology in this particular case, comes in to help you out with, well, here's what's actually happening inside people's brains. And then the whole thing actually has much broader consequences than you might imagine from a purely aesthetical thought experiment, because actually it is the same situation that we deal with in a very important discussion currently going on in our society.
So many people, as you know, center their lives around the idea that morality is given to us by God, who commands us to live accordingly. What does science suggest, contemporary science, about the human tendency to believe in God?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Until very recently, religion was really kept outside of sort of the scientific purview. Scientists didn't really, first of all, it's a delicate subject matter, obviously,
yeah,
but also scientists really didn't have much of a handle on it. And it's a kind of complex social and historical cultural phenomenon that it's very difficult to study scientifically. But things have been changing quite dramatically over the last few years. And in the book in particular, I bring up two sources of evidence about religion as a natural phenomenon. One is, of course, evolutionary biology studies of where a sense of divinity and a sense of the transcendent comes from. You know, why do so many people have this very strong sense that there must be some higher power somewhere out there in the universe? And then the other one comes again from neurobiology, because neurobiologists can actually tell you what's happening in your brain when you are involved in, let's say, deep meditation or deep prayer, and you're having essentially a mystical experience. I think what is interesting there is that although we certainly don't have at the moment a particularly clear and completely accepted story about how religion came about as a phenomenon, I think it's quite clear that some components have to include of the story, have to include things like human beings have a natural tendency to project agency, meaning that we tend to think that even inanimate objects sort of are, have a will. I mean, if you have ever experienced, for instance, getting upset at your computer as opposed to the makers of your computer,
right,
then you know what I'm talking about. It's like, you know, you stupid piece of thinking. And then it's about, wait a minute, but it's a machine. It's not doing anything. It's not actually doing it on purpose. But the immediate reaction we have is that we sort of project agency on these things. Now, this projection of agency probably was advantageous early on in human history, because it made us much more aware of things like predators, for instance, and probably saved our lives. But once you have this tendency to project agency, you will do that everywhere. And in fact, sure enough, the very early religions or the very early set of beliefs in human history were in fact essentially panpsychists. That is, people tended to assume that all of nature was pervaded with some kind of sense of consciousness and some kind of ability to act. And then eventually from there, we moved to a little more sophisticated situation where we started discriminating between different types of agency, and we started thinking that individual elements of nature, let's say the sun, the moon, you know, different planets, had in fact divine agency. And then eventually this process of concentrating agency into more and more abstract terms and more less and less personal ones eventually culminated into, of course, the evolution of the monotheistic God of the Judeo-Christian Muslim tradition. But so we have a naturalistic explanations about the process of religion, you know, where that thing comes from to begin with. Then the question, of course, in terms of morality is, okay, now that we know that, what do we do? What are the implications mm-hmm. of that sort of stuff in terms of moral thinking? And it turns out that there, again, I think the philosophy comes to the rescue, or at least to some help. As it turns out, it was Plato, back almost 2.5 millennia ago, that in a beautifully written and short, very accessible essay called the Euthyphro, which your listeners can find for free on the internet, he built up this dialogue between Socrates and this character Euthyphro about the origin of morality, about where do we get not the evolutionary origin, obviously, but the where do we get these moral rules from? And the answer that Euthyphro was giving to Socrates was, well, clearly we get them from the gods. And Socrates is very intrigued by this statement, and he starts, poking at it and asking probing questions to Euthyphro in what has become since known as the sort of Socratic method. And at some point, Socrates asks the crucial question, which has been known for the last 2.5 millennia as Euthyphro's dilemma. He says, look, bottom line is, tell me if which one of these two is the case. Do we think that something is good because the gods say it is, or do the gods say that something is good because it is good? And Euthyphro thinks about it and he says, well, clearly the first one, whatever the gods say, is good. And Socrates says, well, not really, because if you think about it, the gods are capricious, they could change their mind, that means that, all of a sudden they could decide that genocide or rape, these were not, I'm paraphrasing here, of course.
Right.
But, they could decide that something that we think is awful, it's actually immoral. What is going to happen at that point? You're going to do it just because the gods say so. And Euthyphro says, well, that's true. That's pretty arbitrary. So it must be the second choice, that the gods say that something is good because, in fact, it is good. And Socrates says, aha, but if that's the case, then we can figure that out on our own. You don't need the middle man or the middle god as it is. It means that morality is, in fact, independent of divine agency, that we can figure it out on our own. How do we figure it out? Well, we have a whole area of human endeavor known as moral philosophy or ethics that tries to figure exactly that sort of thing. Now, the reason I think this is a very interesting argument is because for 2.5 millennia, people have tried really, really desperately to find some logical flaw in Plato's argument, and they couldn't. Plenty of theologians, obviously, want to argue that somewhere the Euthyphro dilemma falls apart, because if it doesn't, that really does mean that regardless of whether God exists or not, he has nothing to do with morality.
Mm-hmm.
And as you pointed out, a major reason people believe in God is because we think that we derive our morals from the divine. But as it turns out, according to Plato at least, if you buy that argument, no, we don't. And it's not an argument against the existence of God. Plato did believe in gods. He just didn't think that they had anything to do with morality.
Massimo Piliucci is my guest. He's professor in the philosophy program at the City University of New York's Graduate Center and author of the new book Answers for Aristotle, How Science and Philosophy Can Lead Us to a More Meaningful Life. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We will be back to our conversation with Professor Piliucci in a few minutes. Right now, we would invite you to call us or go online to kera.org, make a contribution of support, perhaps choose a copy of Answers for Aristotle, a really accessible, entertaining book that combines really interesting theory or thought, thinking about the value that essentially explores the value of science and philosophy in science. Jeff Whittington is back with us now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. Yeah, call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. Make your contribution of $10 a month as a sustaining member. You can set it up on your credit card, your debit card, or through your bank account. Or you can make a $120 contribution all at once, and we will send you a copy of Professor Piliucci's book, Answers for Aristotle, with our thanks. And, of course, you'll also be entered to win this Washington, D.C. trip sweepstakes that we have going during this membership campaign. Everybody who makes a contribution during the drive is entered to win, and the winner will get to do all the usual things that tourists do in our nation's capital. You know, you can visit the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, etc. But you'll also be able to do two things that very few people have done. You'll be able to sit in and witness the broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show. You'll be able to also watch a broadcast of either Morning Edition or All Things Considered from the mothership at NPR headquarters at their brand new building that's going to open in April. Everyone who contributes, as I said, during this campaign is automatically entered. So you might just be going to Washington sometime this summer when you make your contribution at KERA.org or on the phone at 888-694-6931. This is a pretty exciting deal, Chris.
You know, I have not sat in on the Diane Rehm Show, but I've heard her describe how it goes. And my understanding is that she sits there like a traffic cop. She's pointing to guest one and holding her hand up to guest two. And she's sort of orchestrating the whole thing as if she is conducting an orchestra. And I think it would be really interesting to see. And I think you'd be able to always have that in your mind from here into the future when you listen to the Diane Rehm Show.
Yeah, it's a great opportunity for some lucky listener.
Could be you.
It could be you. And we have lots of ways that you can be thanked. Of course, we mentioned Massimo Piliucci's book, Answers for Aristotle, How Science and Philosophy Can Lead Us to a More Meaningful Life. It's a great conversation today. We're getting some great comments in our inbox, Chris, think@kera.org. If you're enjoying this conversation, if you enjoy the show on KERA, as many, many, many of you do, we know that many thousands of you listen to this show every day and every week. Well, we're just asking for you to decide that it's worth a contribution and any amount. Please make that decision right now and help us wrap this membership campaign up in 7 days. This is our fifth day of active fundraising, so we're hoping to wrap it up by Thursday. But we got to hear from you in order to make that happen.
KERA is a not-for-profit organization that serves the entire North Texas community, and it serves you and your family every single day. You know when you turn on the radio to 90.1, the station will be here bringing you updated news and information, bringing you solid discussions of really interesting and important issues, occasionally bringing some entertaining information, but really here for you all the time. Please be here for us once a year, starting today at KERA.org or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Massimo Piliucci, who is professor in the philosophy program at the City University of New York and former professor of biology at Stony Brook. His new book is called Answers for Aristotle, How Science and Philosophy Can Lead Us to a More Meaningful Life. Okay, Massimo, I don't want this hour to go by without talking about love and sex. sex, at least, is pretty easy to understand and to document now, according to science alone. The emotion of love, on the other hand, seems to be another matter entirely.
Yes, that's correct. Love and sex is definitely one of the most interesting topics, I think, in the book. And there, again, it's another example where I think we can get a pretty good insight by combining the science and the philosophy. So, on the one hand, the chapter on love does go into, to some extent, the evolutionary biology of, you know, why do we develop these very strong feelings for other people? Well, that one does have to do, and it's not a big mystery, with, you know, reproduction. And essentially, as Richard Dawkins once put it, as disgusting as the thought may be, every single one of your ancestors had sex at least once, otherwise you wouldn't be here. Now, that said, so that's the easy part. It's a little more interesting and complicated to figure out actually what's going on inside our brains when we fall in love or out of love and, you know, when we react in certain ways to other people. And as it turns out, there are certain very specific hormonal changes that happen in the brain of people who fall in love and fall out of love. And the value of knowing this stuff is not a question of, we take the poetry out of the experience, you know, now it's all about a biology and all that sort of stuff. That's not the point. The point is, once you understand why you feel certain things and your certain very strong emotions, why you might feel actually, you know, very disturbed by what's happening in the middle of a relationship or toward the end of a relationship, if you realize that, well, that's actually normal. You know, everybody goes through that sort of stuff, and what's happening is that certain chemicals are flooding your brain because in response to your experiences with the other person, it sort of brings it back to earth. It brings it back to, okay, this is a normal thing. There's nothing to be too worried about it. Yes, I need to deal with it. Yes, it can be very painful sort of psychologically, but it's not like it's not the end of the world, and it's not like nobody else is going through it. But as usual, the point of the book is, of course, also to bring in the philosophy and say, okay, fine, it's all about, it started out as being all about reproduction, and it does deal with hormones and all that sort of stuff in the brain. Now what? Now what am I supposed to do, however, when I'm in the middle of a relationship or when I'm at the beginning of one or even more complicated toward the end of one? That's where the philosophy of love, literally there is a field that it's referred to as the philosophy of love, comes in, because then philosophers have been interested, for instance, in developing and reflecting on what it means to be in love with a person, what kind of how should we treat the person. If, for instance, you know, let me give you one very simple example. Often when you ask somebody, why are you in love with that person, the response is something along the lines of, well, you know, she's beautiful, she's smart, she's funny, etc., etc. So that basically they give you a list of characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
But it can't be just that, because if it were just a list of characteristics, then that would raise the problem that philosophers call the problem of fungibility. The problem of fungibility is easy to understand if you think about cars instead of people. So, you know, if you ask me why you like that car, I can say similar things, a list of characteristics. Well, I like the color, I like the way, you know, that it looks and the way it reacts when I drive and all that sort of stuff. Yes, but given that I like the car because of a set of characteristics, there's no issue, no problem of any sort when next year model comes out that has the same characteristic but better, and so I can trade up.
And we know that happens with marriages, but not all the time.
Right, it does. But the difference between, of course, presumably between a car and a human being is that the car being an object and a human being a person, fungibility is not something you can object to in the case of cars, but it is something that a lot of people have ethical qualms when it comes to a person.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question is, well, why? If you really love that person just because of a list of characteristics, there shouldn't be any problem with fungibility. And it turns out the philosophers have articulated different ways in which you want to think about the other person, some of which have to do with the fact that, well, there is an additional obvious element there, which is you have you're building a unique personal history with that individual. You're building a unique set of experiences that are shared. Those are valuable and cannot be replaced by, you know, doing the same. You know, you're not going to go on the same vacations or have the same children or whatever it is with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Those things become unique. They're not fungible anymore. And also, of course, depending on which ethical philosophical framework you subscribe to, if you are, let's say, a Kantian, as in somebody who likes the sympathetic to Immanuel Kant's approach to moral theorizing, then you also realize that it is, in fact, immoral to treat other people as a means to an end. They need to be treated as end in themselves, which means that if you, in fact, trade up, and you are, in fact, violating the Kantian imperative. You are treating people as objects, not as individuals with their own value, intrinsic value, not just an extrinsic one. So that chapter goes into both the history and the philosophy of it. So on the one hand, to bring down the whole turmoil of love to earth and say, look, it's perfectly fine. It's a biological process and it's a psychological process. It's normal, but at the same time, it's also the way in which we reflect about it, the way we can think about our loved ones is precious. As far as we know, we're the only animals that are capable of doing that sort of thing, and that is a unique dimension to being human that needs to be cherished and thought about.
Yeah, and if you think about it, I mean, science would struggle to even quantify a quality that means a great deal to us, a quality like loyalty. It's hard for scientists to put that in a box and study
That's right. Mm-hmm. You can measure, I suppose. You can always, you know, scientists are very good at coming up with sort of quantifications. But the fact that you measure something doesn't necessarily tell you why you should value it. I mean, that is one of the major things that I stress throughout the book, that, yes, we can do the science of almost anything, but the science by itself doesn't necessarily inform you on your values and why you should value certain things more than others, or how do you resolve conflicts between things that you value and they come up in sort of in conflict with each other. There you need an ability to reflect critically on the meaning of the things you do and why you do it, and not just quantify and count the stuff. You can always quantify. It always helps to count. but in itself, it doesn't give you all the answers.
So I want to talk about this as we close up here. You know, reading this book, it occurred to me that we talk a lot in education, and I'm talking K-12 education, let alone at the university level, about the STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, and math. There's
right.
no P on the end of that. And I wonder
right.
if you think what you think might change about the way we approach education if we made room to consider philosophy a subject worthy of studying even at younger ages.
Well, I think that would be a very good step forward for American education. It is done in other countries. A lot of other Western countries do teach philosophy at the high school level, in a few cases even before that. And there are some attempts to do that in the United States. There are a couple of departments of philosophy in the U.S. that actually specialize in developing curricula and materials for teaching philosophy to the kids. But of course, as you say, it's not part of the sort of the standard STEM disciplines. I think that's a mistake, because if anything, one could argue that philosophical literacy is even more important than science literacy. And I'm, as you know, I'm saying this as a scientist, so it's not like, you know, it's not a matter of envy here, disciplinary envy. It's a question of, look, it's very important that people understand basic things about science, you know, what we refer to as basic science literacy.
Mm-hmm.
But frankly, most of those things are actually not going to be particularly useful in everyday life. I mean, you know, if you know or do not know about the periodic table, that's not necessarily going to make much of a difference in your life. On the other hand, if you know the basics of critical thinking, if you know how to recognize, you know, a logical fallacy, for instance, a bad way of making an argument, now all of a sudden you have an incredibly powerful tool against politicians and, frankly, a good portion of the media. And now you can navigate the news. Now you can make decisions about who to vote for in a much more informed way. And that comes from a study of philosophy. And by philosophy here, I don't mean the usual, frankly, somewhat boring history of Western philosophy, let's start with the pre-Socratic kind of thing. I mean, that's interesting in itself, but what I'm talking about is really the study of critical thinking, the study of how the human brain can actually go wrong when it thinks about stuff, and of course, the study of ethics.
Massimo Piliucci is professor in the philosophy program at the City University of New York's Graduate Center and former professor of biology at Stony Brook University. His new book is Answers for Aristotle, How Science and Philosophy Can Lead Us to a More Meaningful Life. Massimo, it is always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks to all of you listening today. We really appreciate especially the 25 of you who have made contributions. We would love to hear from a handful more, 1,000 more. We would frankly love to hear from everybody who is listening that has not yet secured a membership to KERA. You can do this now at kera.org or by calling in to 1-888-694-6931. Support the station that values ideas, values lifelong learning, a life of the mind. We know a few things about you as an audience. You come from all different parts of North Texas. You maybe originate from all different parts of the country and the world. But the KERA audience is united by this reverence for respectful information and lifelong learning. Your presence in our audience is something we really cherish. Your financial contributions allow the station to operate every day. You pay for more than half of the operating expenses of this radio station. Please go online now to kera.org or call 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is back in studio now, senior producer of Think, host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. I want to thank Nick Brooks in Dallas for contributing. Thank you, Nick. Thanks to Allison and Dan Lorimer in Dallas and Lynn and James Swartz in Colleyville. We'd love hearing from you, especially during the Think Show, since this is, after all, your locally produced talk show that's right here for you in North Texas. And, of course, people all over the country do listen to the show. Many, many people listen to the show via our podcast, which many times has been the number one non-nationally distributed public radio show in podcast numbers from NPR. And so we're always really thrilled to see those numbers and to see that you enjoy the Think podcast and that you listen. Well, providing the podcast does have a cost. We have, staff members who have to edit and produce and post that. Christine McConnell does that. We have our director of interactive, Alan Melson, who oversees some of that too and make sure that everything works. And, you know, we're all bringing you this service and giving it to you essentially for free for you. And then a couple of times a year, we come on the air and we ask you to support it out of the goodness of your heart. But really, we're asking you to take responsibility for the fact that you listen and join the other 25 people out of the hundreds and quite potentially thousands of people listening to the show today. 25 of you, thank you so very much, have given. Well, we hope that you will join those fine folks and make this station a reality. Make the station strong now and in the future.
Thank you so much, Deborah Spangler in Dallas, Olga and James O'Reilly in Dallas, and Laura Johnson in Dallas. You can join these good folks at KERA.org, or you can go and call 1-888-694-6931. We have many, many thank you gifts available, including those that we haven't mentioned for a few days, but you thought, I would really like to have that French press coffee mug, or I would really like to have the book that you talked about last week. All of that is there, or most of it is there. So check online or ask the person on the phone, and they should be able to hook you up. If you've been waiting, if your hesitation is that you've been waiting to hear a thank you gift mentioned, please don't let that stop you, because we'll get that to you. We'll make it happen.
888-694-6931 is the phone number, 888-694-6931, or go online to KERA.org. Send us an email to think@KERA.org if there's, if there's something that we're not saying that you think makes a really great case to you, to your friends, to your family, to strangers, to people who you know listen to the station, people like yourself. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe, there's an issue that I can help resolve for you. Well, email me at think@kera.org and tell us why you're still waiting to make your contribution to KERA. Even if you disagree with something that you've heard on the station, chances are, I think there's a pretty good chance that you've agreed with some of the things you've heard on the station. You know what? Public radio and journalism and news and media and reality really isn't always just about being able to agree with everything that happens in the world or everything you're presented with. We hope that what you hear on public radio gives you a well-rounded idea of what's going on in the world, so that you can then make your own decisions about what to think and what to believe. That's what it's all about. That's what you're supporting when you make your contribution.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. Of course, you can go online to KERA.org. A contribution to the station goes to work for you throughout the year. It provides solid quality journalism. You know, I think sometimes it's so easy to be sitting there in your car, or maybe you're at your desk, or you're running errands, or you're doing whatever you do every day while listening to KERA, and you hear us make these pitches and you kind of tune out, right? Because we're all so practiced at tuning out the sales pitches that barrage us from all over. This is not a sales pitch. We're not trying to sell you anything. We are not selling you any of the thank you gifts. We're not trying to pull the wool over your eyes. We are just saying, look, that this service that you've come to count on relies on the support of listeners. As I understand it, there are other stations, other markets where a greater percentage of listeners sort of steps up every time there's a membership campaign and makes a contribution. We would love to be one of those stations. KERA is known as a flagship for producing local programming, for winning awards. We would love to invite more of you to see how easy it is, how affordable it is, and how great you feel at the point at which you become an official member of the station.
Here's the fact. If everybody who listened to the station gave $10 to the station a year, we probably wouldn't have to do the membership campaigns. If everybody just automatically gave just $10 to the station, because we know that about 400,000 people listen to the station, and you can do the math. That would pretty much cover our membership goals for these on-air membership campaigns. But the sad fact is that not everybody gives who listens to the station. And, if we could get away with not having to take the time to do the membership campaigns, believe me, we probably would. I mean, if there was a way to give people a chance to remind people that it's so important that you support your local public radio station, and in this case, it's KERA right here in Dallas-Fort Worth Denton, well, we would do that. But the fact of the matter is, this is the most efficient way. Believe it or not, this is the most efficient way, the most direct way, and the most transparent way for us to raise the money necessary to bring you what you hear on KERA.
Think about the hours you spend listening to this station in a regular week. Maybe compare them to the hours that you spend watching TV or watching Netflix and how much those subscriptions are for you, and apply an amount accordingly to KERA. You have heard and will continue to hear how that money goes to work for you and for the community. You will enjoy quality journalism. You will know that you have taken an active role in something that really matters to you. Please go online now, make your contribution at kera.org, or call us at 1-888-694-6931. We really do need and appreciate your help.